Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air. This week, Brock joins us with a review of Karen Miller's Clone Wars Stealth Duology of Novels. And we have a Q&A with Hasbro discussing their Clone Wars toys. Now, let's join Jerry to discuss both episodes that kick off Season 3. Clone Cadets, and ARC Troopers.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Republic Forces Radio Network. We are back with Clone Wars. So, no, we're not talking about droids today, although there are two episodes of the Droid Retrospective series that are on their way, so keep checking out and looking out for those. We are here today, though, to celebrate the kickoff of Season 3 of the Clone Wars, and I am joined by our cast of hosts. We've got Jen.
Hey.
Back from a summer hiatus, we have Barrett.
Hey, everybody. I'm happy to be back, and I'm so excited.
And he just can't hide it. He's about to lose control, and I think he likes it.
I've lost control.
And join us, Nathan P. Butler.
Hey, ready to see some secrets revealed, apparently.
Oh, you know, I was just assuming, though, based on the other seasons, that the secrets revealed wouldn't come until, like, the last three or four episodes of the season, though, right? Isn't that the trend?
Pretty much, yeah. It sounds like it.
Okay. But, hey, but you know what? I'm going to enjoy the ride there, so. All right. Well, we had two episodes, and the second episode will be coming in the next episode of Republic Forces Radio Network, which will be airing here later in the week. But we are starting with Clone Cadets. It's the first episode, obviously, of Season 3, first in the production order for Season 3 as well. This is kind of interesting. I wasn't expecting this. I learned it just earlier this week before the show aired, or I guess last week, rather, that this episode is a prequel to the Season 1 episode Rookies. And I thought that was really interesting. Before we get into the episode, what did you guys think about that? Did this work for you to be jumping back in the timeline to things that happened in Season 1?
Well, let me start. I was totally surprised that we had a jump backwards in time. And, you know, the first thing I kept thinking was, how is this going to mess with continuity? You know, how, what's Nathan going to say? To find that we have ARC Trooper armor, the Phase 2 armor, right off the bat, they show you the Phase 2 armor, and it's a prequel before Rookies. So right off then, I was like, I know Nathan's going to have something to say about this, because this is not what we've come to expect, you know. Well, it's actually what we've come to expect from the Clone Wars, but it wasn't what I was expecting. I wasn't expecting to get blown out of my shoes with the first episode.
I thought it was pretty cool, you know, going back and seeing that. I think at first, when I started watching the episode, it took me a second to get my mind around the fact that it was a prequel. They didn't really hype it up as such. So when I started to hear those names, it sounded familiar. I was like, oh, this must be beforehand, because obviously they wouldn't be training after they'd already been at the post. And then it turns out a couple of them, oh, they're the ones that died. So obviously it has to be a prequel to it. I think the way they handled the entire evening went well, though, because not only do you have this one as a prequel with Rookies sandwiched in between it, of course, but then the second one that wound up airing did a very good job of just very briefly mentioning the Rishi base and moving on with its story. So it was something where you could either watch the two back-to-back and enjoy it, watch it with Rookies in the middle and enjoy it, watch them separately and enjoy it. I think they really hit the nail on the head when it came to a way to present this for as broad an audience as possible to enjoy without feeling like they needed the Rookies episode right there in between. It's more like the icing on the cake, so to speak. I really liked it.
Do you think, though, that they should have played Rookies in between, like made it an hour and a half event? I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you, but I kind of wish, because I don't remember exactly the names and which one died, which one did, watching the third episode and the way they presented it worked, but I kind of wish they played them together, because I'd like to see them together. I partially almost wish that they would put these three together on a DVD, you know, just as a, you know, three episodes back to back, because, you know, now they're going to be split up on different Blu-ray sets. We already have Rookies. I kind of wish they'd play them together. What do you guys think about that?
It didn't bother me. I actually thought it was a nice little homage. I was so jazzed to see the characters back because I loved these characters in Rookies. That didn't really bother me. I was just happy to see them, period. But I thought it was actually kind of nice because then it made me want to go back and explore season one again. And I remembered enough that it, like, I remember, for example, that Echo and Fives were the only two that made it out of that episode that I kind of, it didn't really, I wasn't really confused about who had died and who was still alive because we knew who made it. I just loved it that it was backstory and we got to revisit these characters, not once, but twice. So it was, I was just so happy. It didn't really bother me at all that there was nothing missing though, or that they had cut and left Rookies out and not aired it all together. I think that almost would have been too much.
Yeah, I think that would have given you that turnoff factor. I mean, the whole thing that they talk about in TV ratings is that whole idea of retention, audience retention from one program to the next and that whole thing. I think if they had aired Clone Cadets and then aired Rookies and then aired ARC Troopers, what you would have found is a lot of people clicking away from Cartoon Network for half an hour to click back to ARC Troopers, or perhaps clicking away when Rookies began because it was an episode they'd already seen before and not returning for ARC Troopers, not necessarily understanding how that was going to be set up. I think you'd be setting yourself up for issues there, and it wasn't really necessary to put Rookies in there. All you need is that quick little blurb and the fact that this is, you know, the knowledge that this is a little further down the timeline, and you just kind of go with it. I thought of it much less of the first episode is where we start, and the second one is a long way down the line, so they're skipping stuff. Much more like we were seeing a prequel to the one that is then more of a present-day type of story within the context of the rest of the series. It was more like we were just getting the lead-up to it rather than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think if people knew there are three episodes, premiere, Rookies was well-loved, I think a lot of people have stuck around for it. I understand what you're saying, though. For me, it was just kind of an afterthought that, because I'm a little uncomfortable, not so much to the point that I thoroughly enjoy these episodes, just to say that up front, but I find it a little just awkward that they're doing things like this that, hey, it turns out people really like the concept of Rookies, so let's do two more Rookies to kick off the season. We'll do one before, one after. The concept is clever, but I don't know, it was a little jarring not having Rookies sandwiched into them. And like I said, if they put out a DVD, I guess I'm giving Lucasfilm Marketing an idea right now. If you put out a DVD with just these three episodes, just so I can watch them together, I'll buy that. I'll totally buy that.
I think what the issue is here is we're all thinking of this in terms of when must they have come up with the idea to create this? Was it an idea just for season three? Could it have been something created earlier? And if you really think about it, looking at, I mean, this episode was not a Anakin slash Ahsoka slash Obi-Wan slash Asajj Ventress, et cetera, type of episode. It basically was made up of, with the exception of the clones, all new character models. We had Shaak-Ti in it. We had Brick. We had El Riss, I think is what the guy's name was, the other one that was voiced by Nolan North from the Uncharted games. We had the different clone armor, the training armor. We had Colt with this, not really phase two armor, it's like a hybrid. We'll get into it in Continuity Corner, but we've got that new armor being seen. We've got this entirely new sort of quasi-holographic, almost like a holodeck type thing with obstacles built into it that can change type of training area. We've got 99. I mean, there's tons of these new character models being built. And then you have, within these two episodes, you also have the young clones that we saw for the first time back in the finale three episode arc, so to speak, from season two. It seems like this is an episode that maybe they could have conceived earlier, but they would not have been able to pull it off from a resources standpoint earlier. So I'm not sure this is one of those things where they thought Rookies went really well, so let's go back to it. I think maybe it was one of those where the idea had always sort of been there, but you know, every season they ratchet up how many character models, how many environments they have that they can use, and maybe it took getting to season three before they had that level of resources there to be able to do it.
Well, I may have misunderstood, but I kind of took it from Dave Filoni's comments at Celebration 5 and some other places, I can't remember where, that it was sort of, hey, people really enjoyed that, we thought we'd revisit, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure, I mean, I totally take Clone Cadets as a way to further what we're seeing in this season. I mean, it was good to see that prior to seeing the second episode. They build off each other fine, so I don't think it's just a, well, hey, that was really popular, let's just do it again. But it almost seemed like it surprised some folks that episode did well so well, even though I think a lot of people were talking about that even before Clone Wars as a series started, that we hoped to see things like that. But either way, I think generally we have some good results here. But let's go around the table and just get our initial general thoughts about Clone Cadets. And as always, Jen, ladies first. Why don't you start us off?
I loved this episode. I don't think there could have been anything better to start off the season. Like, I'm going to fangirl over this episode probably the entire time because there was pretty much nothing in it that bothered me enough to even complain about at all. I was a little bit jarred for like maybe the first 5 minutes or so as to when this took place. But as soon as I realized it was a prequel, I was perfectly happy. And it was just really, really good. I loved it. I love revisiting those characters. I loved getting to see a rejected clone, 99. I know we're going to get into him. But I loved his character. He was so much fun. And while they didn't really touch on the same things as the Republic Commando books, they didn't kind of stomp all over it like I was afraid of when I first realized it was going to be clones in training. I feel like I could coexist very easily with it without too much fuss. So I was just, there's nothing I didn't like about this episode. I was really happy.
Okay, great. Brent?
You know, I have to agree with Jen that this episode just basically blew my mind. When I was at the San Diego Comic-Con panel with Mr. Filoni and he was discussing what we're going to be seeing, you know, and Arnie made it quite clear about all of the water, you know, it was a big deal about the water. So, you know, I was going and kind of expecting to see a lot more water and a lot of fighting outside and stuff. But what we got was, I'm an armor guy, you know, my focus on collecting is clones, is troopers, is armor. And I always considered the clones to be, you know, they're basically the slaves of the Republic, and how that fits into the story of Star Wars. And I'm always clamoring for more clones. And, you know, one of the things I really liked about this is a lot of the clones here have the same look. When we're watching some of the other Clone Wars episodes, some of them are bald, some of them are blonde, some of them are this or some of that, because they've seen some combat, they've been out there for a while. But here in this training facility, they pretty much all have the same standard haircut. You know, they're very similar looking, but the way the story progressed, I could recognize who Heavy was. I could recognize who Fives was just from their character. And to be able to pull that off after, you know, we're pretty familiar with clones. To be able to pull that off, even though we know that these characters, who they are, because we've seen them in Rookies, it was just, I was just amazed, you know, and to see the training armor and Sergeant Brick. And I have sent away for a couple Sergeant Bricks, and I was like, that might be kind of a mistake. You know, I don't know this guy. And he was a great character. I know we're going to get into the bounty hunter aspect of this episode, but he was a great character. I really like Sergeant Brick. I mean, this gave me the Clone Wars. You know, this gave me a backstory that I thought had been missing. You know, how are these clones trained? You know, who's training them? You know, from what we have in the EU, you know, nobody knows if that's up in the air anymore, you know, if that's even canon. So we know that what we see here in the Clone Wars episodes are canon, and I was very satisfied, very happy for what we got.
Okay, yeah, and for sure we'll be entering that concept as a bounty hunters training and Brick and as a topic later on. Nathan, how about you?
I was really, really happy with it. There really wasn't anything major I felt that I could complain about throughout the entire experience of this straight through two episode thing. My girlfriend and I were sitting there watching it. She's been watching most of them with me because usually we get to hang out and stuff on Friday night. So usually we kind of sit down. It used to be Stargate Universe and Clone Wars, and it was a debate over which one to watch first and that sort of thing, which one to DVR, which one to watch. Now, of course, the universe has moved, so it's straight up Clone Wars, and it usually won anyway. But here we are, you know, we're watching the Clone Wars, and she's not heavy into the Star Wars stuff like I am. I mean, she's a fan, but she's definitely not really, really deep into it. But she was really getting into the characters. We were joking around with it, just having a lot of fun with it. It was a really enjoyable, fun, just hour of television. Now, that's not to say the episode wasn't amazingly predictable. I mean, the story of this episode, you could have plotted out and a connect-the-dots thing with any number of stories that are of similar vein. But it took what would be essentially a predictable storyline and did it in such an enjoyable, fun, entertaining, engaging way that I didn't mind the predictability. When I can see a story that is predictable and not mind that fact, especially in something I love as much as Star Wars, that is a high compliment. And this episode really, really did it well.
Nathan, I agree with you. And starting with my general comments, I'll build on that a little bit. What I liked was is that it just showed us so many new things about the clones and Kamino and how this whole clone army thing works and the characterization of these five clones and the introduction of the new characters like the two bounty hunters. It was so interesting and so well written. I completely agree with you. I mean, we all knew the five clones were going to pull it together and get through the final battle. I thought it was kind of interesting the twist they put on at the end, and we'll talk about that here in a little bit, but I totally agree with everybody. I really enjoyed this episode and thought that it was a great way to kick start the series for season three. And like I said, I make the comment about I wish they'd played rookies, not as a criticism in so much as to say that I got so interested into this concept again that I kind of wish I could see that too. In the next day or so, I'm going to pull out the Blu-ray and watch that episode specifically. I actually didn't watch these on Cartoon Network. I got them off iTunes, and I am going to intentionally do that and watch this one, Rookies, and the next one, and just see how it flows. So, bravo. Great way to start off the season. So, let's just jump into the main concept here. What did you guys think about the X-Men Danger Room that they started off with?
Did anybody else get American Gladiators?
Yes.
And no, yes, I didn't.
American Gladiators.
I was like, this is American Gladiators to the, you know, ate its Wheaties.
Did you see did you see the one droid with the tennis balls, though? That's what really nailed it for me.
I kept picturing Hulk Hogan being back there, that Brick was Hulk Hogan. He's like, it's American Gladiators, baby, you know, like he did.
It was great because it was familiar. You know, it was real high tech and the way they're being trained. And it made sense that that's how you would train clones in a facility, because Kamino is not very, is not, you know, you don't have open air and fields and stuff, and I guess you could train a lot of them on the boats outside, but it makes sense that that's how you would train these clones. You know, before I seen this episode, I always thought, you know, how do they train these clones? Is it Lamassu? You know, how are these Kaminoans training these clones? Or do we have, like, you know, assassin Kaminoans out there that just don't make elixirs, but actually, you know, take a knife to somebody's throat? You know, how does that work? And it makes sense. It totally makes sense. You know, you can train a bunch of clones in a lot of time, you know, very short period of time, very efficiently in something like that. And it just fit.
I actually really like seeing the training just in general, because we haven't seen much of it before, kind of like what he was saying. But also, it was something that... And this really didn't dawn on me until I watched it a second time. I also got it off of iTunes after having seen it on Cartoon Network HD. And yesterday morning, of the time we're recording this, yesterday morning I was interviewing Shannon McRandall, who was the model for Mara Jade for all those Decipher and then some Wizards of the Coast CCG cards and such. And she has three children, the middle of which is big into Star Wars, huge, huge, as she says, Star Wars geek. And then she's got two that are, you know, a little bit less into it as a case, maybe one very young, one a little bit older. And her husband is a Navy vet. And she said that when they get together and watch it as a family, and thank goodness somebody out there is able to watch these things as a family, seeing all that the things that my students go through, but when they watch it together as a family, she said that this is something that prompts the kids to ask their father stuff like, is this how you really train, Daddy? Is this what war is like? It's opening up that door. And I guess I'd seen this in last season, seeing all the different terrorism angles and such and pulling the connections to real life and that sort of thing and how it sort of brings up the topic for discussion. But I guess I never really saw the other side, the more positive side of what it could bring out in terms of, you know, just seeing a military training, seeing what army people would have to go through, seeing basic training, seeing the different drills, seeing the different tests they have to go through to eventually reach the point where they are able to go out on the battlefield, like what all goes into it. I think from that standpoint, this episode provides a really great look, thanks to the training that we see here, at sort of something that maybe opens kids' eyes up a little bit, or at least opens a door for those types of conversations. Something, like I said, I would never have noticed had it not been for what Shannon was talking about, but it really, really does seem to be something that jumps out at you on the second viewing. Wow, this is stuff that kids maybe have never really seen before. They're used to characters going out and just jumping into the action. But the training that goes into it, maybe not. Maybe this is a conversation starting episode.
Well, and I think too, and that's really interesting, Nathan, it is showing, let's call it, the ugly side of war. I mean, especially in the next episode when we see casualties. But what I thought was really interesting along with that is the concept that not all clones are going to make it, and that there are genetic accidents and rejects from this cloning process that gives us people like 99. What do you guys think about that?
Oh, you know, in an earlier podcast, Arnie had mentioned that, I forget what the context was, but he had mentioned that maybe Lamassu was more of a salesman when it came to his clones in episode 2. Like, we built the grandest, the best army we've ever built. And I thought it was very interesting. This is the first time we actually see, quote-unquote, Bad Batcher. And he actually says that, you know, since Jango Fett is not around, they're not successful every time. And it was the first time that he's actually coming out, and now that he's already made the sale, you know, now it's time to do some spin damage. And it was interesting to see that different aspect of Lamassu, you know, as a, you know, I can't be right all the time, instead of, you know, this is the best army we've ever made.
Well, it's interesting, Baron, because you have the concept here that, well, since Jango Fett's dead now, we're taking, I suppose, what little DNA we have that we're just now copying and copying and copying over again, whereas it sounded to me like the concept was we go back and get some fresh sample every so often, which here's the thought it sparked for me. Well, wait a minute. You guys have Boba Fett in captivity. He is, well, maybe not in this particular episode, obviously, because this was a flashback, but now that with the results at the end of last season, Boba Fett is a prisoner in the hands of the Republic. Might you dig into that? Because that should be pure Jango Fett samples. You think we'll see anything like that? That'd be kind of cool.
I thought it was kind of cool. I also thought it was kind of cool that they suggested that Lamassu suggested to the Jedi they find someone else. And I feel that they're going to maybe revisit this issue because they kind of glossed over it. You know, that's kind of a big... you know, Shaak Ti's making a lot of big decisions here. You know, I had no idea that she was the one actually in the Jedi General that was in charge of overseeing the training of the clones. I mean, if you can step in here, Nathan, is that something that's been out there, or was this the first time that we've actually learned this?
As far as I know, this is a first, but I could be wrong. I just don't ever recall having ever heard of Shaak Ti being one of the ones overseeing the clones. But you have to assume that the different generals probably at some point had some role in oversight. Maybe, I don't know if it's so much that it's her all the time or if it's her turn or what.
But in any case, she's there in an earlier part of the war, an earlier part of the Clone Wars series. And she's the one making a lot of decisions. You know, you don't see Shaak Ti going in and calling the Jedi Council for anything. You know, she makes the decision to have these clones retake the test. She makes the decision, you know, or makes the decision to or not to get another donor. It's another thing that just blew my mind, something I've never thought of before. You know, you go into these things thinking that you've thought of every possibility, every way, you know, every turn, every side to things, and all of a sudden they come out with this, and what you thought you knew, you don't know anything.
Well, and I think the thing about that, Brent, is that we haven't seen a decision made on that. I kind of gathered that whole line about you may want to find another donor as just a, oh, wait, see, that's the reason why not all stormtroopers in the original trilogy era necessarily are the same person. Some are clones, some aren't. They went and got new donors. I kind of took that as a leading in to the unanswered questions, and we can just kind of surmise what we want to from that.
That's actually an answered question, because Lucas himself has even said that part of the reason why the stormtroopers stink in the classic trilogy is that some of them are copies of a copy of a copy because Jango Fett is gone. I don't remember if that was in one of the commentaries or what, but Lucas himself has made the comment on that one. As for Shaak Ti being the one to train them, as much as I hate to say this, I've heard of several instances now from people just since Friday of little kids asking basically, Mommy, is that Ahsoka all grown up? And since we already know that Lucas has this thing about, you know, kill off Anakin Solo so you don't confuse him with Anakin Skywalker and all those different things, or do this just in case people confuse him with someone else, I wonder if Shaak Ti has essentially been under wraps so that that connection with Ahsoka, maybe as like a parent or something like that, isn't accidentally made by the kids. So now she shows up in season 3, now that Ahsoka is much more established. I'd like to think that's not the reason, but it would certainly be in line with some of the previous decisions made as far as which characters are allowed to be at the forefront.
I loved Shaak-Ti. I was really happy to see her. I've been waiting for her because she's one of my favorite Jedi, period. But I love that they, I feel like she was portrayed more as a, as what I've been kind of envisioning a Jedi to be. She was very, very kind of withdrawn and calculating. There was very little like emotion from her, but at the same time, she had this very kind of like a core of not generosity, but she at the same, she was very forgiving, but she was not an emotional person. And it was very interesting to see her character working with these young clones who kept failing, yet she was really not quite ready to just toss them in the garbage. And speaking of tossing them in the garbage, going back to the rejects, I was so happy that they actually addressed that, because they've kind of made little references to it, and I know it's all over the Republic Commando books about rejects and bad batchers, and I never thought this series would have kind of the cojones to go there and actually have one hobbling around, this little Quasimodo guy, and that was fantastic. And I loved 99. He was a great character, and I thought he was going to be, you know, just kind of there, and they shuffle him off somewhere and never talk about him again. So the fact that they addressed that and gave him something to do and gave him this really great character was fantastic. I love that. And I hope, I was upset he's gone. But
if I can sort of build on that, though, looking back at this, if these two episodes had not aired back to back, I'm not sure that I would have been happy with how they handled 99. Because, yeah, 99 was able to prove to be sort of a mentor figure for Heavy by the end of Clone Cadets. He becomes more heroic by the end of the next one, but by the end of Clone Cadets, yeah, he gets to affect Heavy a little bit, but for the most part, he's being picked on by everybody. And it seems like, just like if it's a conversation starter for the kids to say, you know, is this how real armies train, doesn't that also present this message of, don't worry, if somebody's different, if somebody has some type of physical deformity or whatever you want to call it, physical disability, in this case deformity as a disability, then it's okay to make fun of them and pat them on the back when they do something good. I think the way the character was handled in terms of characterization was great. The way the other clones interacted with them and how it was never really put in its place, at least not until the second episode, that, again, if these episodes were aired separately, I do not think that would have gone over so well with parents.
You know, I have to kind of disagree. I thought they did 99 very well in terms of that, because there is the part where they were teasing the different person, the different clone, the Bad Batcher. You know, they're making, they're giving him, you know, a name that's, you know, making fun of him. But he redeems himself even in the first episode, where he's the mentor. He's the actual, you know, it kind of goes to, you know, the Breakfast Club, where the janitor, you know, is the one that has the keys to the castle. You know, everybody underestimates the janitor. Everybody underestimates the chauffeur. But, you know, they're the actual ones who are the most wise. They know what's going on. They know your little dark secrets.
You know, I think you're right, because one of the things I thought was cool is that you kind of got that little line dropped about, oh, you know, like you, huh, 99. Then later he makes a statement that, well, you know, I'm not a failure. I never got my chance.
Right.
I thought that was a great line, because that, I think, Nathan, to counter your point a little bit, is that, yeah, I mean, the unfortunate reality is people are going to look at, in our society today, folks like that who, oh, they're not capable, they're handicapped, you just got to give them some slack. And he said, no, you know what? I am capable. You all never gave me a chance. And then, but to your point, Nathan, the second episode really showed that, wow, that guy got all the credit finally from his peers. And you're right, Nathan, because of the two episodes back to back, it all came together. But I think even the first episode, I love that line, I never got my chance. I thought that was really good.
99 never felt sorry for himself. Even when Sergeant Brick says, you got as much sense as this Bad Batcher over here, he defends them and he says, you know, you're not giving him enough credit. He stands up for himself. You know, he may not, you know, push each other around like Fives and Heavy were doing, but he doesn't feel sorry for himself. He knows what he is, he knows what his job is, and in that aspect I thought it was handled very well. And if they would have just shown the first episode, you know, me as a parent, when I have to admit, when they were pushing him around, I thought, you know, this isn't a good thing. But then, you know, whether you're different or not, kids are going to try to tease you and push you around. And the child that stands up for themselves and shows that, you know, they know who they are and they know what they can accomplish if given a chance, you know, then the kids will actually kind of come around to that. So I thought if they just showed that first episode, I think 99 still would have came through as the amazing character that he is.
I guess I was just looking for someone to stick up for him. I was looking for, like, Shaak Ti to say something, or for Heavy, upon coming back to the group with the new nickname, to say something, to have some indication that there had been an understanding of, we were wronging this guy, and now we're going to stick up for him, and if you keep treating him the way that we were always treating him, you're going to have to answer to me. It didn't seem like there was any moment where there was an overt transition of the attitude. Like, now that Heavy's fine with him, it's okay, but the other guys are still going to treat him like crap, you know? It just, for some reason, it didn't ring the way that I guess I would have wanted it to or expected it to. But, you know, that's, I guess that's personal opinion. I teach a couple of team talk classes now of SEC students, and it just seems, it seems like an odd way to handle it.
Thing about with 99, though, is he doesn't wait for anybody to stick up for him. He does it all on his own. He kind of jumps up immediately. I can show you where the weapons are. I know how to get there. Here, go here. And he doesn't need almost someone to stick up for him. That's how I felt. He sticks up for himself. He shows through his own actions entirely on his own that he is worthwhile and he is a capable person. So that's what I thought. That's where I got the meaning out of it. And that's why I thought it was so great, because one has to do it for him.
But that's the second episode when that happens, though. That's why I'm saying that the first episode had aired separately. I'm not sure the message would have gotten across. I'm glad they aired them as a pair when it came to 99.
What do you guys think about the concept, aside from 99, but the concept of, we've got clones that are not deformed, but they're just not going to cut it, so just put them in maintenance. I've never really heard that concept. What do you guys think about that?
I'm going to jump in again, because I'm a big, big fan of the Republic Commando books, and so I'm sure those will probably come in continuity corner, but like, they talk about those all the time, how there are clones that scrub out, that just don't make it, and it's really cold hearing them talk about that, especially that one guy, the one instructor who's just like, no, they're crap, get them out, toss them. And but it, at the same time, when you first see Lamassu and the Kaminoans in episode 2, they talk about them as units and programming and docility, like being injected into their beings. Like, they are not seen as people until they're kind of out on the field and they get developed on their own, and their generals interact with them. So seeing them in training kind of being referred to as getting kind of thrown in the trash, it was kind of hard, but at the same time, it was something that fit in with the rest of the Star Wars universe that we'd seen prior. So I thought it was really kind of neat to see.
Well, see, now I like that perspective from some of the novels too. So to me, it was kind of brand new. I'm like you, in my head, episode 2 is like, we're cloning them, they're all the same. So how is it they really develop their own personalities? But I think the whole concept too explained in here with, we're pretty far removed from the original donor of Jango Fett, helps me piece that together a little bit as well.
I was kind of surprised by the fact that, I mean, I was surprised with them when they appeared in the Republic Commando books too, but just the idea of any clones that don't meet quality control standards, so to speak, because of how corporate-minded the Kaminoans are, because of how inhuman, basically, they view all of these clones, they essentially view them as products. I was surprised that any product that doesn't meet specifications is allowed to exist at all. I always saw the Kaminoans much more like sort of a Margaret Sanger-esque eugenics type of concept. Like, they would have said, well, you are not fit, therefore we're not going to waste the food and the money and the time on you, and they would just kill them. I guess the fact that there is such a thing as a washout clone or a defective clone, so to speak, that can still be alive, to me, changes a little bit of how cold I always viewed the Kaminoans, along with, you know, Lamassu in this case, the voice seemed a little bit, not warmer, but, you know, leaning in that direction. It's granted, it's a different voice actress. Bob Bergen, I think, is what his name is, the guy that did Luke Skywalker for a bunch of the video games. But, you know, Lamassu and all the Kaminoans take on a slightly different feel to me when we know that clones that don't measure up don't immediately get euthanized. That struck me as surprising with Republic Commando, and especially here since it's emphasized.
And moving on a little bit with the training themselves, how did you guys like the dynamics among the Domino Squad clones specifically?
Team Domino Squad. I'm glad we got a name for the squad, because in Rookies, I don't think they were referred to as Domino Squad. They were just referred to as Rookies. But now we know where the Rookies started. They started off as Domino Squad. They started off as the Bad News Bears of the clone cadets. And it's just great. It's great that I'm going to have to sit down and watch Rookies, because I'm sure that they got the personalities the same. But to see how they were trained and see how they grew and how they got their names, you know, Fives is CT34, whatever his name, 555. And he says, I'm Fives. And Echo is Echo because he, you know, he keeps saying the orders over and over again. And Heavy is Heavy because, you know, he carries the heavy gun. And it's just, I thought it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. I mean, you're taking these clones who are supposed to have no faces, no characters, and you're making them into characters that you're wanting to see more and more of. You know, now Echo is pretty dear to me because, you know, I spent a lot of time looking for that Echo action figure. I could not find him anywhere. And now I'm so excited, and I'm going to get an Echo, a Fives, possibly get these in their training armor. And so, you know, when I'm going into seeing the episodes, you know, I'm always wondering what kind of toys they're going to make, because it's the collector in me. But I thought it was great. I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Well, let's go into a little bit about these bounty hunters then, Brick and LS. I mean, I'd be honest with you, at first, I didn't get that LS was a bounty hunter. He just didn't come off that way to me. Brick, you could kind of just tell. He was almost seemed like he played the boot camp sergeant really well, which, I mean, I know he's Sergeant Brick, and I presume that's something that the Republic forces gave him, that because they hired him on to be a trainer. What do you guys think about that? I actually found that concept a little weird, that you have to hire bounty hunters to train. Aren't there any sort of people with military experience within the Republic forces that you would use to do that? Because I kind of question the loyalties. How much did Brick really give a crap about this versus just, they're wasting my time, let me train more people and make more money. It kind of seemed like he came through in the end, but it just seemed like something I question about the Republic forces. And let me ask this question. Is it the Republic forces or is it the Kaminoans? Who has ownership of the clones at this point? Obviously, Shaak Ti's involved. Do the Kaminoans get paid until they're trained and graduated? How's that work?
I actually thought it made sense to have the bounty hunters as the trainers, because they're kind of a neutral entity and all they care about is their pay. Whereas, like, if you had people from a specific planet, like a militia or something, coming in and training them, then you could potentially have this political baggage almost, or blackmail material almost, to like leverage to hold over someone in the Senate, or, you know, we're more important because we're supplying the entire Grand Army with training, or we're not as important because we're not being allowed to, you know, donate our militia generals or something to that. So I thought it actually made a lot of sense. It didn't bother me at all.
You know, I'm going to have to agree with Jen. I think bounty hunters get a bad deal sometimes, because bounty hunters are one of the most honorable characters in the Star Wars universe. You know where their loyalty stand. Whoever has the biggest pocketbook, whoever's paying them the most, that's them. If I'm paying you, you're on my side. There's no, you know, bounty hunters are not going to double cross you. They're pretty honorable. And I thought it made a lot of sense. And, you know, I was reading some comments on the forums, and I can't remember what forum member said it, but one forum member said that there is a scene where the clone says, I'd rather have a Jedi training me than some mercenary bounty hunter. And the bounty hunter says to him, the Jedis don't have any time to train you. You're a grunt. The forum member said, you know, the absolute, how funny that is, that a clone would think that the Jedi would train them. Clones are not force sensitive. The Jedi they're not going to take the time to train a clone. They have to train their own Jedi. You know, why would they take the time to train somebody who wasn't force sensitive? And after reading that comment, it may even made a lot more sense that you would have a bounty hunter. You know, bounty hunters are tough. They've had combat, maybe not military combat, but they've been in the trenches, and they're going to finish the job. Once you pay a bounty hunter, they try to finish the job no matter what. You got classic, tough bounty hunter in Brick. And then in Ellis, you got the bounty hunters from season 2. You know, kind of emotional, kind of, you know, I'm going to defend the farmers type of bounty hunter. we got the best of both worlds in this episode.
I think it's also possibly, maybe, one of those nods where Dave Filoni was trying to make a nod to the EU, and maybe it didn't come out exactly the way that it might have otherwise, but it certainly seemed like perhaps one of those EU nods, because the idea of bounty hunters or mercenaries being the ones to train the clones is not necessarily a new thing. If you look at the Republic Commando books and elsewhere in the EU, one of the things that Jango Fett has to do early on is assemble a group of people who are going to be the trainers for the clones. And among them are mostly, though I think later on they say the ranks included some others, so mostly, in this case it could include Brick and LS for all we know, they haven't really said either way, but it's mostly these Mandalorians and others who are known as basically those who have disappeared, or those who have who are no longer known, or however it is that it translates to. But it's the Kui Val Dar. It's these people who disappear. They have to give up their previous lives. They have to basically let everyone believe that they're dead or that they've disappeared, because they have to go into hiding, basically, and train the clones. And for 10 years, between right around the time of the Phantom Menace, whenever the clones' army is first being ordered, and the time of Attack of the Clones, when, of course, the clone army is unveiled, they spend those 10 years basically in hiding, in seclusion, on Kamino, constantly training clone after clone after clone after clone. It would make sense that as the war goes on, maybe more of them are needed, maybe there are more clones being produced, whatever, that they would supplement those ranks with the same type of people they've used to train the clones previously, which in this case would be more mercenaries, more bounty hunters. As long as they're bounty hunters that fit sort of the mold that Berent was just saying, where it's someone who you can trust to do the job. You pay them whatever their politics are, you know they'll do the job. I find it a little bit ironic that what Jen was saying a second ago about how a bounty hunter doesn't necessarily have any particular cultural ties to a particular planet, so you know that they can be neutral in how they treat the clones, which is funny given the fact that of the members of the Kui Val Dar that we have seen before, the majority of them being Mandalorians, they're anything but neutral in the sense of culture. They're politically neutral, but the Mandalorian trainers are beating Mandalorian stuff into their heads, at least as far as Cal Skarada and the Republic Commando books go, so we wind up with this very heavy Mando influence on the clones. What I'm concerned about is now, here we've got bounty hunters, we have a similar situation, but what happens when one of these clone groups, one of these squads, particularly perhaps a Republic Commando squad, as we know they'll show up later in the season, what if one of those squads is sent out to Mandalore and says, "What's a Mandalorian? I've never heard of them before," or something like that, where here you still have the ability for all those Mandalorian trainers to still exist. It's just these other bounty hunters are in there with them. It's the question of, will anything be done to expand upon the training that will invalidate previous stuff? That, I think, is what people should be concerned about. All this whining that a lot of people are doing right now over, well, what are these bounty hunters doing here? They're not Mandalorians. It still works, but they just got to be careful with it. You know, it's a controversy that doesn't need to be one. You know what I mean?
Well, Nathan, actually, I think that's a really good segue into Continuity Corner for some of the other items that jumped out in the show. I want you to take us down there.
Well, there are quite a few things that are being brought up about this episode or these episodes. We'll start with the armor, so we don't have to mention it next time around. A lot of people are concerned about, wait a second, this is Phase 2 clone armor, which is not supposed to be introduced until about 2 years into the war. Why are the clones, or at least the ARC troopers, wearing this particular armor? Dave Filoni talks about it in his video commentary for ARC troopers. If you look at them carefully, this is not actual Phase 2 armor. Consider it maybe Phase 1.5 armor. It's like an experimental blend of the two halfway between that we actually haven't seen before. It's still got the fin like the original Phase 1 armor does, but it looks a lot more like Phase 2. So it would make sense that they would put a new type of armor into production, into testing, you might say, with the ARC troopers before they decide to roll it out for everyone else. In a couple of years of battle testing, seems like something that might be reasonable. So I think the armor controversy is probably another one of those that is much ado about nothing, but it would only be something that would be cleared up if you really look at the details and how it's not quite Phase 2 armor, or if you go and listen to Filoni's comments on the matter. Let's see. We have the fact that there is a battle on Kamino coming, but we'll talk about that in the next episode, even though it aired the same night. We have the ARC troopers who are introduced here. We saw them previously, I mean, we saw the commas and everything, the ARC troopers back in the Genndy Tartakovsky series. More about them also for the next episode. Really, the only thing that stands out from this one of the night that I haven't previously mentioned is Bravo Squad, who is that good squad that seems to have been on their way towards becoming ARC troopers. There is a possibility, though I think it's a relatively low possibility, that these ARC trooper Bravo Squad group, or this Bravo Squad that eventually gets trained more, might be meant to be, or be made into being, the same Bravo Squad that is mentioned in one of the Republic Commando books. I believe it was 000. My guess is that's just fans and wishful thinking, because Bravo is not exactly an unusual name to give to a squad. So, generally speaking, the biggest stuff that we got this time is just with the clones returning from Rookies. As far as Domino Squad itself, of course, we did see them again in Rookies. There was another one with them, Noob, or Nub, N-U-B, who was with them. But these original five do return. That is Heavy, Fives, Droid Bait, Echo, and Cut-Up, who all appear. And, of course, Heavy gives his life at the end of Rookies, so we know what happens to him. Droid Bait, and I believe it was Nub, wind up getting killed during the episode as well. And, of course, we have Cut-Up being eaten by that Rishi eel when it comes through, the one that has the, what the hell was that, that wound up being cut from some of the different releases of that episode. So by the time Rookies is over, only two of these remain, and those two, Fives and Echo, were the ones that set up the adventure for the next episode that we saw on the premiere night, ARC Troopers.
You have the ARC Troopers, and you have the clones training to be ARC Troopers. Now, I was under the understanding that ARC Troopers were bred to be ARC Troopers. Is this the first time that we're actually getting where regular clone troopers are trying to train to be ARC Troopers? Because I know that Captain Rex, his part of his backstory, I believe, is that he was a regular trooper who was so extraordinary that he became an ARC Trooper. But from what I understand is that ARC Troopers are bred. No? Is that not right anymore?
Well, the way they initially talked about it was that the ARC Troopers were bred with sort of that certain amount of more personal decisions, more of a personality. They're not quite as rigid in following orders as the other clones are. But I believe, and this is something that somebody may have to correct me on, I know that later on there was this implication that they could wind up seeing someone be promoted from being a trooper to being an ARC trooper. But that came in some of the later EU stuff. It may even have first been noted in one of the RPG guides. But I don't think it's the first time we've ever heard of it. I think it's the first time it's really been heavily used. I know we've seen troopers become Republic Commandos, but that's a different thing than an ARC trooper. But even then, Republic Commandos are assumed to be of a slightly different breeding stock, so to speak, than otherwise. But then we have the example of one of the characters from the Republic Commando books who starts out as a trooper who winds up joining one of the squads. So it's an iffy thing. Certainly not this early in the war. You would not expect characters to be able to be promoted. But then again, we don't know exactly how early in the war the ARC Troopers episode actually is. The idea that, hey, you could be on your way to being an ARC Trooper could have been just kind of hyperbole to buff up their spirits. It's certainly earlier than we would have expected. I'm not sure if it's something totally unheard of, though. And speaking of earlier, something I did forget to mention, as far as the order of these episodes go, we know that Clone Cadets comes before Rookies, and that ARC Troopers comes later. Dave Filoni and the episode guide at StarWars.com says it comes quite a bit later. It's not an immediate follow-up to the events of Rookies. However, this has led to some discussion of when this must take place, because obviously there's no Ahsoka in either of the episodes aired on the premiere night. So the question becomes, well, is she just gone? Or could these be, as Filoni and others have suggested, an instance where you take the absence of Ahsoka as an indication that these episodes happen very early, perhaps even before the Clone Wars film? My guess is that's probably not the case. They've already said repeatedly that Cat and Mouse from Season 2 is the earliest in the continuity they're going to go for the Clone Wars. So Clone Cadets would not seem to take place prior to that. Given the fact that in the second episode of the ones we saw on the premiere night, we have Broadside, one of the pilots, who shows up in Shadow of Malevolence, and they refer to him being last seen in Shadow of Malevolence, my guess is that the episode we get second takes place probably at least past the midpoint of Season 1, if not already into Season 3, where it's like a present tense compared to all the other episodes that we're seeing. My guess for this episode, given the fact of when Rookies takes place, I would say this episode is probably taking place either right before or concurrent to the Malevolence episodes, probably maybe around Ambush, perhaps, because it seems like it's more Ambush than the Downfall of a Droid, Duel of the Droids, than the Malevolence stuff, at least continuity-wise so far in the way that it all makes sense. But I would definitely not say this is a prequel in the same vein as Cat and Mouse and The Hidden Enemy. It's not nearly that early based on the hints we've gotten so far. It is definitely, though, somewhere sandwiched between those early season one episodes, which does make it unusual.
All right, well, that was our panel discussion of the first episode. Jen, Nathan, Baron, and I continued to discuss ARC Troopers, which we'll get to in a moment. But first, we'd like to take a pause and thank our sponsor for this week's roundtable, Backstage Toys. Backstage Toys has all your cute little deformed figures available. Of course, Star Wars Galactic Heroes lead the way, but there are also G.I. Joe Combat Heroes, Marvel Superhero Squad, Transformers Robot Heroes, and even non-Hasbro chunkies such as Batman and Power Rangers. They have most of the 2-packs, the cinema scenes, and that awesome puppy ad available. So go and check them out at BackstageToys.com. We are back to discuss episode 2 of our double episode premiere night, ARC Troopers. So it is the second episode of the season and second in production order, of course. And we have a big bat on Kamino that we've heard all about in the off season during the summer. So what'd you guys think?
I love this episode. It was a great episode. We got to see, this is something we talked about with the C5 Republic Forces episode. Asajj Ventress hasn't done much. We got to see her do stuff and she kicked a lot of butt. So we'll probably go into that later, but I was really happy to see that she didn't just kind of run away and hide. She was pretty close to winning and Grievous kind of screwed her out of that, but I was happy to see it. And I'd love to see the Echoes and Fives again. So this was just another great episode, another really excellent way to kick off third season.
We have the return of Grievous and Asajj, something I've been waiting for because I kind of feel that sometimes Asajj gets kind of put to the back burner. She's not being used as she should because she's kind of in that gray area of Sith. You know, she's not really an apprentice, but she is training under a Sith. She's not really this, but she is an assassin. And, you know, she's kind of in that gray area of evil. I don't feel she's always being used to the dimension that she could be. I think she was here. She was totally more interesting. Before we started recording, you know, Nathan had mentioned that maybe her head tattoos seem a little bit more, were different or something. Or, you know, I just noticed them better because she was a more interesting character. She was evil. I like the dynamic that she played with Grievous, and I know we will get into that episode before this. You know, sometimes, you know, in season 2, they had a habit of giving you some action-packed episodes, and the next episode was kind of like a cooling-off episode, and it wasn't like that at all. It gave us characters that we had in the last episode right into this episode that were a little older and a little wiser, but still the same characters that we could relate to, and it was great.
I really liked the episode. I mean, this was a really action-packed one. I think it was probably the most action-packed we've seen since landing at Point Rain, only this one actually involved water. It was fun. It was another one of those ones where I just sat back, enjoyed it, had fun watching the entire hour, so this latter half really was building up. It was great to see that it did connect back to both rookies and to clone cadets. It was almost like jumping over rookies to eventually get to this episode, but it definitely felt like there was a connection. So this event made a lot of sense to see these two episodes back to back. It was really kind of cool to see a battle on Kamino in film form. The first time we've ever seen a battle of Kamino in T canon. Granted, it's like, what, the fourth time we've had a battle of Kamino overall, because we've seen it in video games, we've seen it in comics and elsewhere. But to see Lucas's spin on what if the Separatists attack Kamino, which is a very obvious target, was really cool to see. And in that vein, kind of stepping back, given the fact that if you look at the films, of course, most of the clones, or many of the clones, were computer-generated. And of course, the backgrounds and everything in the buildings and such on Kamino, most of which computer-generated and such. Once again, kind of like with landing at Point Rain, we have a situation where they're recreating in Clone Wars style CG stuff that was previously seen on film as photorealistic CG. And I gotta tell you, this episode blew me away visually. There were several times when watching this that I had to almost snap myself back to reality because I almost started to think I was watching something photorealistic or something like we'd see in a live-action Star Wars film, not something we'd see in the Clone Wars. So a fun romp, visually stunning, not anything really big to complain about this one, with the exception of the fact that I really wish that Cartoon Network had had the guts to keep what amounts to one of my favorite Asajj Ventress moments of the entire series that gave her more personality than she's had in the entire rest of the Clone Wars thus far.
Well, don't keep us in suspense. What was it?
Well, apparently, it was apparently previewed at Celebration 5. It is now floating around there on YouTube and such. But yeah, there's that moment where she grabs the clone and pulls him to her so she can stab him through with a lightsaber and then drop him to the ground very early in the assault. And apparently, the clip was too controversial, I guess, for Cartoon Network or something, but there was a version of that that you can kind of even see the way that it's edited. It's almost like it's edited roughly together, where she would have grabbed him, pulled him forward, stabbed him with the blade, and then leaned over and kissed him, and then let him fall to the floor, which really, I think, adds a lot to it because she seems much more sexualized in this episode. I don't know if it's just because knowing about that scene, I was looking for those types of cues with her, but it certainly seems like it, and it just adds so much to it. I mean, how many times have we heard Obi-Wan Kenobi call her darling and see that sort of playfulness back and forth, which I always thought was something, you know, maybe there was some connection between the two that we don't know about that they're going to spring on us at some point, but maybe she's just an over-sexualized character and that's how she treats her prey. She plays with them as if they're toys, and here we see it, or would have seen it if it hadn't been cut. Austin Blankenship he's one of our guys with Solo Sound for the EU cast and so forth. He made a great comment. He said, you know who's probably ticked off about that cut? George Lucas himself. Because this is exactly why he didn't want to go with major studios when making Star Wars in the first place. Because they would cut stuff he wanted to show.
Wow, that's really interesting. Before I get into my opening thoughts, I did want to comment on what you said earlier, Nathan, about the look of the show. I agree with you on that. I found it almost as if that this show is evolving so much visually. Of course, we know that. I mean, Filoni talked a lot about that at Celebration. He used, you know, you're watching Atari 2600 while we're making Xbox. And I think that's pretty good because, for instance, I don't think there's anything overly stylized about the way Shaak Ti was depicted. She just looks like an animated version of Shaak Ti from the movie. Now, granted, her alien race is kind of stylized to begin with all the colors and everything, but I started looking forward on Anakin and Obi-Wan, and it just seems like all of them are starting to look a little bit more natural to me with the motion, with the movement. General Grievous looks like a General Grievous, not a weird disproportion Tartakovsky type General Grievous. They're starting to look more normal. What'd you guys think about that?
There's one shot where Grievous is looking, I don't remember what he's looking at. I think he comes off of like a shuttle or something and he's looking out over Kamino or something, but you can see his eyes like flicking back and forth, like in his weird like mask. And that was the point where I realized just like, wow, this is how far this has come, because I don't think even that level of expression has been in this series before. Like, they've really gotten good at what they've been doing with like expressions and with motion and with the like his cloak moving and just the effects of the water and explosions. It's fantastic now.
This animation is groundbreaking. It's been groundbreaking, but I think that this is the third season. We're not disappointed in what we're seeing, but just the colors and the tones and the shading, all the way to, you know, little smudges on Shaak Ti's face when she's fighting. Almost like football, black football marks. There's just a little bit of graying on her cheek. I mean, they're coming so far. And when you watch anything else out there, as far as animation, I mean, you're not going to get this level of quality of images unless you're actually, you know, watching Despicable Me or something on a movie screen. I mean, the level of detail that they're putting into these characters, it's just amazing. I agree with you, Jen. This show is evolving seriously, and it's fun to watch how it's evolving and to try to keep up with it.
You know, Brent, I think you're right. There is nothing on TV right now that looks like this, especially for what's a quote-unquote kids cartoon or a Cartoon Network cartoon especially.
Now let's talk about how it's so amazing seeing this on Blu-ray. Going back to the first season, how my appreciation for the show as a whole changed when seeing it on Blu-ray. I can't even imagine what this season at this point is going to look like when it comes to Blu-ray. If it's not a Blu-ray player seller, it should be. I know the films certainly will be. But this is something, folks, if you don't have a Blu-ray player, then you need to get one by the time this one winds up hitting. Maybe even season two. I mean, season two looked great anyway. I can't imagine what that's going to look like on Blu-ray when it comes out very soon. But this is something that really needs to be seen in high definition. It is gorgeous.
Okay, guys, you know, we've heard a lot about at San Diego Comic-Con, Celebration, about how the animation here is really improved. They can finally do water and rain and things like that. And so we've really been getting a lot building up to this just technical side of it. So this is the Battle of Kamino that we've been hearing so much about. What'd you guys think?
The battle overall was pretty good. They did hype up the water element, and the water looked good. I don't know if it needed all the hype. The water looked good. I think they should have hyped up the secrets reveal part. But one thing I liked about this whole battle is the fact that Rex and the clones consider themselves Kaminoans? Because they said they're attacking our home planet. I know they're grown there, but are they Kaminoans? And do the Kaminoans consider them Kaminoans, or do they consider themselves like Arizona? You know, just because you're born here don't mean you're a Kaminoan. You know, how does that work? And I thought that was, you know, it was just a little snippet right before the clones, you know, Cody and them went into battle. But I thought, how fascinating is that? That's a whole other, you know, thought process that I have not been thinking about. So the battle was kind of a regular battle, but that's, you know, that was what I got out of this battle, was the clones having a sense of their home planet, you know, and it kind of paralleled the Mandalorians. Like, the Mandalorians don't really have a planet, or they used to, or they do, and, you know, where are they from now? And
I actually don't think this was something that needed more than this episode. I think if they had made it longer, just to sort of feed into the fact that, or feed, I guess, out of, or feed on the hype, however you want to put it, I really don't think it would have necessarily worked quite as well. I mean, we've seen multi-part story arcs before, but any time that seemed like they tried to drag out the action rather than going in a different direction for the next part of the arc, it's felt a little bit like it's dragging. If you really think about it, going back to the Star Wars films, generally speaking, usually have their big confrontation at, you know, about half an hour, you know, give or take. I mean, you know, there may be some give or take here and there, but most of what we see is build up, and then there's that battle. And they keep talking about how they're essentially creating miniature Star Wars movies each week. You know, this is the boom, the bang for our buck. If they're going to do an episode that is just battle, it's presented in a lot similar fashion to what we wind up seeing in the films themselves. Of course, it plays out very well. They did a good job of introducing those new Aqua droids. We, of course, have the cool fact that the weird tentacled-type ship that we see capturing Roach of the Hutt in the film comes back, which is kind of neat. We have our first meeting, apparently, at least according to StarWars.com and according to the series here, between Grievous and Ventress in person. We get to see Grievous and Ventress in action at the same time. The only thing we really don't get in this episode, in all the fury of the battle, just how fun it is to just be carried along for the ride, is we don't get a battle between Anakin and Grievous because of what we wind up seeing at the beginning of Revenge of the Sith, they wind up having to come up with a very convenient way for Obi-Wan to send Anakin off while he deals with Grievous again. But from a battle standpoint, it was a great, fun episode. It didn't feel like it had parts that dragged. Everything seemed to hit the right beats. And when Star Wars does that, its action is phenomenal.
I have generally, overall, not liked the battle scenes in most of the Clone Wars episodes. I'm not a person for just watching guns shoot back and forth. It bores me. And some of the episodes in last season, like the attack on Geonosis, I tend to look at things in terms of strategy, and a lot of them didn't make sense to me. Like, let's charge right up to this really heavily fortified wall with our army and just get cut down. That kind of stuff drives me crazy. And so this episode, I was not entirely certain I was going to like, because I thought it was just going to be another just gratuitous gunfire. And it wasn't. It was really, actually, it seemed really well planned, and the clones were using tactics and strategies to take out these new Aqua droids, which were kind of a new strategy, and the way that they were using the refuse from and the shrapnel and all the discarded stuff from the space battle to infiltrate the water city, I thought that was great. And so this is probably the first battle in this series that I've not only not disliked, but actually really enjoyed.
Yeah, I think you can really see the typical Anakin fly the ships in and, oh, this is easy, we got it. And Obi-Wan's like, well, this doesn't feel right. This doesn't feel right. This is too easy. It's a distraction. Yeah, there was a lot more to this battle. And Kamino was in far more danger than they realize, which I thought was an interesting Anakin moment, because we know how Anakin is, and he's just not all there yet. He's not the mature Jedi that he should be. You know, basic downfalls at this point, and I presume we'll see some maturing going on of Anakin more and more. So I thought it was a really interesting play all around. What'd you guys think about Anakin in this episode? And because here we're starting to see the main players.
Anakin had his badass moment of the season. I mean, we thought that it was awesome whenever he killed the guy, you know, who's going to be the cold-blooded killer in the Mandalorian episodes where he kills the guy. Here he's basically saying, yeah, I'm not taking you prisoner. I'm going to let them kill you here. Deal with it. You know, just that cold, it's better to eliminate the threat than risk you possibly escaping later. Or just, I'm sick of you, time to die. I mean, that's kind of the side of Anakin. He would feel perfectly justified in doing it, but it still is sort of that darker version of him. I love the way that Anakin was handled as he finally got into the battle. When he was flying, you know, at least broadside was back from Shadow of Malevolence, but finally when he actually gets to be on the ground fighting, that was awesome to me. But when it came to just his persona and those hints of darkness, they really hit the nail on the head this time.
I totally agree with you. That actually caused me to do a little bit of a double take of sorts to say, when he said that I'm just going to let him execute you, for a split second there, I actually thought that that was going to be the injuries or whatever that was going to cause her to run off, leading us into the, when she appears on Dathomir that we saw, you know, during Celebration and, you know, all that footage. So I actually thought that's when we were going to see it, but you're right. I thought that was a great moment for Anakin, similar to letting, you know, from Senate Spy, letting that love interest, for lack of better words, of Padme, just leaving him to the Separatists and the just what you referenced with the Mandalorian episode. It would be interesting to see how much of this we're going to see with Anakin throughout the rest of the series.
Senate Spy!
Yeah, I didn't want to reference it, but I had to.
My faves. I noticed that Obi-Wan is really depending on Anakin to get him through a lot of things. Well, in this episode, you know, as soon as Obi-Wan realizes that, you know, he can't handle the full attack, who does he call? He calls Anakin. Anakin's up in space trying to do his thing. Obi-Wan does not hesitate, asks for Anakin's help. There was no chiding in Obi-Wan in this episode towards Anakin. You know, usually Obi-Wan is, you know, kind of training him still by saying, you know, your emotions or this or that. There was none of that here. It was how Obi-Wan saying, you know, we were like brothers. And that's what we got this time. They were interaction like brothers. You know, it wasn't master and apprentice. It was, you know, I need your help. Come help me. You know, I'm on my way. You know, that's the kind of stuff I like to see. You know, because when you take away that master-apprentice dynamic, then you get to see things like, you know, Anakin saying to Grievous, you know, making his own decisions on how he's going to do things, and I'll just let him kill you here. You know, would he have done that if Obi-Wan was standing next to him? Probably not. But that's what I want to see.
You know, Baron, I think that's a great point. It kind of makes me just a little curious too that when we see Anakin in episode 3 with the opportunity to just really do the same to Dooku and just kill him right then and there, he's so hesitant until Palpatine says, do it, and then he doesn't, he kind of feels bad about it. I wonder what happens to him different, because you think he would really, really want to do that to Dooku. Just like Palpatine says, you want revenge, well, you'd think he wouldn't think twice about lopping off Dooku's head, but here with the Ventress, yeah, they're going to kill him. They're going to kill you. They're going to execute you right now. Just get ready for it. So I thought it was interesting.
Well, it's like you said, he's not all there yet. He hasn't really matured yet, and presumably by the time of Revenge of the Sith, we expect him to have matured at least a little bit, and he would realize that, you know, that's not something that he's supposed to do. Plus also, you know, if you want to put that into context of who his audience is, I mean, here his audience is essentially his men. Then, in Revenge of the Sith, the audience is the man that he has looked at as a father figure for years, who he wouldn't want to let down by betraying the Jedi ways and so forth right in front of him, you know? So I think it's sort of a matter of maturity plus the audience for the act.
While we're talking about Anakin, what did you guys think about just overall the lightsaber battles, particularly with him and Saj Ventress, and just kind of their one-on-one battle?
Whenever Anakin's in a battle, it's hard to not think of him as Darth Vader. You know, we know he's Anakin, we know he's the Jedi Knight, he's the hero, but it's hard to not think of him as Darth Vader. And Asajj used the Force a lot in her fighting. More than Anakin used the Force. I don't even think Anakin used the Force. I mean, I may be incorrect, but there was two instances where Asajj used the Force in her advantage in the fight. One, where Anakin catches her in the DNA chamber, and she uses the Force to push him back so she can get some leeway from him. And the second one is when she escapes, and there's a bunch of clone troopers, and she uses the Force to push them back. I want Darth Vader to use the Force. I want Darth Vader to Force choke Asajj. The lightsaber battles are okay, but we know what happens. You know, it's kind of hard to get excited for a Asajj Anakin lightsaber battle or a Grievous Obi-Wan battle. We do not know how Asajj dies. So whenever she gets in a battle, it could always be that time when she goes. When they're doing these battles, I cannot help but get the feeling of it's kind of like the A-team dismembering a bomb or something like that. You know they're not going to get blown up. So why put the bomb in there every week?
I'm not sure I would agree entirely, but a lot of the menace is gone. No Star Wars pun, but a lot of the menace is gone because we know what happens to these characters. Assuming they decide at all to stick with the expanded universe, and who knows if they actually will. You know, Filoni says he has that respect for it, but it's always George's decision. But we know, at least in the end, not necessarily how Asajj Ventress dies, we know how she leaves the war. We see it in Obsession. She reaches a point where she has sort of a change of heart, and she just goes off on her own. She leaves. She goes AWOL. She disappears. She doesn't just die. And Lord only knows what's going to happen if she dies in this series and the ramifications that's going to have on continuity overall because of the events of Obsession and such, the comic book series. I think, to me, what this one echoed more than any other time we've ever seen these characters near each other or together is it made me sit back and think of the Genndy Tartakovsky series. Like, when is their first real encounter? When is their real later encounter? You know, what order do these take place in? And it really, to me, kind of screamed, you know, just think about the ferocity with which they fought on Yavin 4 back in the Tartakovsky series versus the ferocity that they have right now. And assuming the order still is that was when he was a Padawan, and here it's while he's a knight, so this comes after that. It seems almost like an unfinished business kind of thing. I felt much more of a ferocity and a sense of, you know, this time it'll be different kind of coming from Anakin in this battle than usual. So I guess what I'm looking for is, if you're going to do the same battles over and over again with characters we don't expect to actually die, then use that as a moment for character development. And I think this one, probably more than any other one, maybe because Ventress was given more development in her portrayal here, the way they animated her and everything else, it seemed like this one gave us actual development a little bit for those two characters and their interactions. I'm still waiting to see the same type of thing happen with Asajj Ventress and Obi-Wan Kenobi, so we can see a little bit of where that whole darling aspect and such comes from. I would also add, just on the, since the general question originally was about just the previous duels as opposed to just the Ventress and Anakin one, this is one of those times where it really felt like we were purposely seeing an echo, no pun intended again, purposely seeing an echo of Revenge of the Sith in the battle between Grievous and Obi-Wan. We got the same sound of the spinning sabers as he's going around. It really seemed like they made an effort in these particular battles to give us something that connected on a broader level and gave us sort of another layer to it that we wouldn't necessarily have gotten from some of the previous ones. Because, I mean, I'm right there with everybody else. You show the same duel over and over again. Eventually, it just gets boring if you know that they're just going to wind up breaking off and escaping. It becomes a question of how are they going to break off, not how is the duel going to turn out. This time, for some reason, just felt different. It felt a little bit of a higher level than we're used to. It always bugged me that here's Grievous, who's supposed to be this big threat, with this giant army of droids, and Obi-Wan just drops down in the middle and is like, "Hello there," and is just pulling out the saber with a smile on his face, getting ready to kick Grievous's butt. And I think, I mean, granted, people keep talking about how as much as Grievous gets beaten, it's sort of defanging him, and how somewhat supposedly easily he got taken out in Episode 3, depending on your point of view, and the fact that he ran away sort of took away some of his menace. But I think really this adds to the credence of why he would run away, why he was weaker in Episode 3 than we thought, because here he is pulling out some of the same tools he used against Obi-Wan there, and he doesn't win. And it's kind of the same type of thing, like, no wonder Obi-Wan drops down with that smile on his face. He's kicked Grievous's butt or fought him to a standstill so many times that he's just kind of thinking, bring it on. Oh, this will be easy. You know what I mean?
I bring it up as a topic because for some reason, Nathan, like you, I thought there was something else to these lightsaber battles this time. I typically, Brent, would be in your corners like, okay, get the lightsaber battle done and then let's just get on with the story. But I found them fascinating. I don't know if it was because they're intertwined between Obi-Wan and Grievous and Anakin and Asajj, but there was something I enjoyed about seeing them. They seemed a little faster and more intense to me, to borrow a phrase. So, you know, I enjoyed watching them, and I thought they worked in these episodes. It really, you know, built towards that. Now, Nathan, as a side comment, what kind of bothers me is that the Episode 3 novelization makes it sound like that Obi-Wan has never fought Grievous before, and Mace Windu's trying to tell Obi-Wan that, well, really, you're the best one suited to go after him because you've mastered the basic stance of Jedi lightsaber fighting. The rest of us have to do something else because we're weak in some areas. You're not. To me, it kind of takes away from a great novelization in some ways, but I can forgive it. What I don't get, and this is just tongue-in-cheek a little bit, is what is that little stance that Obi-Wan does every time he starts where he puts his hand behind his head and his two fingers out like he's gonna poke his eyes out or something? He's got like the Three Stooges stance set up and ready to go.
I always think of two things when I see the pose. It's either, my name is Obi-Wan Kenobi, you killed my father, prepare to die. Or it's, as soon as he strikes the pose, in the back of my mind it goes, think of that sound every single time he strikes that pose, and it'll be a lot funnier.
Now, where is that sound from?
Yeah, what was that?
A charge sound?
Like, I don't know. It's like a Looney Tunes version of "It's Time for a Mexican Dance" kind of thing. Ole, or something like that. Okay. You know, because you can see him like doing like the little tap dance and then dropping into that pose. You know, like I always picture almost like a Looney Tunes type of effect to Obi-Wan when he does that, because it is such a, I mean, I guess it's understandable that you would have a starting stance all the time. It just really is, I mean, it's an odd stance.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a fighting stance, though. But hey, I'm no Jedi. I don't know how to use a lightsaber either.
It doesn't look like Dooku stance, you know, like.
Oh, I know what it is. I know what it is.
What is it?
Because of the shape, he's putting the two fingers forward, right?
Right.
It's him basically saying, there's going to be two hits in this fight. I hit you. You hit the ground. That's what it is.
He's the bear.
Oh, that's it. That's it.
His stance, he has a stance just like everybody else has a stance. Dooku stance. You know, he brings out his saber, then he brings it up on his, you know, like a Marine. And Anakin kind of has a stance where he puts both of his hands up in the air. He does that in Episode 2, and he does that against the fight against Dooku in Episode 3. You have Sidious, who kind of does like a semi-pointing from the elbow type of thing, shooting from the hip kind of stance. You know, so they all have a stance.
Yeah, he learned how to do his saber fighting while watching the Madonna Vogue video a lot. Strike a pose.
So let's move on to the connection with clone cadets. Obviously, this episode brings the clones together. Cody and Rex, they want to be a part of the defense of Kamino. And we see, I guess, time displaced with 99 and at least two of the clones that survived rookies. So what did you guys think about the clone factor here? I thought it was kind of cool that it was a mixture of not only your young clones, but your experienced clones, your clone commanders, and then even the, forgive my terminology here because we've grown to love this guy but even your clone reject, who are all getting together like one, that the little speech that they got, I think just kind of helps solidify part of the episode and the feeling, hey, this is our home, we're all the same, it's all inside of us, let's go do this. What do you guys think about that?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was just going to jump on that, because that was probably the most poignant part of this entire episode. This is what really did it for me, is they had that moment where they had the young, not even trainees really yet, just the kids, and the sort of pseudo-experienced, like the younger but somewhat experienced Echo and Fives, and then Cody and Rex, who are just like almost these heroes of the clones, I would think. And then this other guy who really adds a lot to it too, and I love to see that each individual kind of, they got to add their own aspect of to the fight. They got to contribute in a significant way. There was nobody who was just kind of tagging along, and that was really nice to see. I thought that was really great, and that kind of leads into 99 kind of proving himself, and then unfortunately his death. He was kind of doomed from the beginning, but like that was really kind of sad seeing him go. So I love seeing the clones do that. Clones are my favorite thing in this series. So seeing them get to have all that characterization, all that time spent on them, was a big deal for me.
They did a great job of showing clones at individuality. By definition, as clones, they're not supposed to be individuals. And that's pretty hard to pull off. Did a great job of showing the individuality of clones.
Thinking about just the way that they handled things with 99, the way it's been described, and I've seen this on a lot of forums, this is definitely not me coming up with the original idea, but a lot of people have compared this to something like Band of Brothers. And I think that's a pretty good comparison. I mean, they definitely give the sense, not as much with the younger clones, a little bit with them in the scene, you know, kind of getting the younger clones ready to fight, but definitely with 99 and the way they react to him, it's one of those things that it's somewhat predictable that either he'll save the day or he'll die, or both. You know, because he's just kind of that character within the mold of this type of story. But, you know, I'm kind of, to coin a phrase, Glenn Beckish, in the sense that if you give me something that is tied into patriotism, honor, service, sacrifice, sometimes it will get me choked up. Even if I haven't seen anything else with it, just that idea brings something out in me that causes me to kind of have that emotional, gulp in my throat, so to speak. And it rarely happens with the Clone Wars when any of the clones meet their end. But when 99 died, and you know, he was a true soldier and that sort of thing, that really kind of caught me off guard, and I really kind of had to choke back that type of reaction for lack of having Jody make fun of me while she was sitting there watching it with me. But it's just kind of one of those things where they really did a very good job of giving that brotherhood sense to the point where I felt it like I would feel from a lot of other productions, but I don't think I've really ever heavily felt from the Clone Wars. Maybe that's why I felt so defensive almost of the way that 99 was being treated and how they didn't really resolve it very well, or, you know, in some respects, in that first episode, because we do see the heroism here. We do see him as someone who winds up being, you know, almost the best of them, you know, that sort of thing. I don't know. It struck something with me, Glenn Beckishly, and for something to do that in Clone Wars is almost unheard of.
Hey, Nathan, why don't you take us down Continuity Corner? And by the way, let me throw out there, can Cody and Rex promote people to ARC Trooper right there on the spot?
You know, honestly, I don't know, but apparently they can. It's one of those things, I guess, that hasn't really been dealt with as much. We know a lot more about Republic Commandos than we know about ARC Troopers. Hopefully, that'll be something we'll see in that new essential guide to the Star Wars military, however it's being titled. Jason Fry is working on that at the moment, and while I can't talk about what it was, he asked me for some advice the other day on it. So hopefully we'll see some of this show up in that military guide one way or another, with Season 3 rolling as he's writing the thing. But broadly speaking, I think we've covered a lot of the continuity stuff already. I mean, we talked about the ARC Troopers in the previous episode and the Phase 2 armor, or the Phase 1.5 armor, whatever you want to call it. A lot of the stuff we've touched on already. I would say probably the one thing that stands out, though, continuity-wise, to keep in mind, is that there have been a lot of different battles of Kamino. We're assuming this is a different one than any of the ones we've seen before, but they may wind up taking this one and blending it in to fit in with one of the other ones, because we saw the Battle of Kamino in, I think it was the 50th issue of Republic. So we saw a lot of different angles on it there, with multiple storylines all tying together. We saw it in the Battlefront video game series. We've seen battles referenced in other books and other guidebooks like Galaxy at War and that sort of thing. So, I mean, this is, it's one of those places that makes for a frequent battle site. And you got to wonder how they're going to fit all of these together. It's very easy to imagine, though, that with it being such a strategic site, of course there are going to be battles fought repeatedly over it. It's a matter of how long do they get to rebuild before the next time an attack comes. But for the moment, this Battle of Kamino, as far as we know, is not yet, at least, the same Battle of Kamino as any of the others. There are at least three, probably more, with this being just one of them, the only one that happens to be T or television canon in this case, the only one directly Lucas invented. Beyond that, I really don't think there's a whole lot to say about this particular episode until at least we know a little bit more about the episodes surrounding it, so we can maybe try to pin it down chronologically. Other than that, though, I think we're good for the week.
Now, I always have a question for Continuity Corner.
Oh, here we go.
No, I have a question. Now, we were trying to gauge, you know, it's almost impossible to gauge when these take place. But we have the clone cadets there. Are we to assume that these are the same clone cadets that were the clone cadets on the ending of Season 2? Because it almost looked like the same leader who stepped up and was talking. I can't remember his name now. And they had the blonde clone in there. It almost looked like the same group of cadets. Now, did you get that it was the same group of cadets or was it different? Because for me, I got the feeling it was the same cadets who had talked to Boba and was in those series of episodes.
I don't know that they were meant to be the same necessarily. The problem with that is that doesn't really tell us much of anything, because they're only aging, at least according to the way it's always been described, they're only aging at double the rate of a normal human being. So as long as these are within about the same year or so of the Clone Wars, relatively early on up to about a third of the way through the Clone Wars, they'd probably still look relatively the same. I don't really think we'd be seeing anything in a different character model, for example, in that sense. And really in that sense, if you look at it, all the times we've ever really seen clones, they've always been either the fully grown clones or they've been these sort of midway grown clones, almost as if they started a batch and then 5 years later started another batch of the clones again. It'll be interesting when we finally do start to see clones who are somewhere in the middle of that maturation process. But so far, we haven't. I would assume nothing can be taken chronologically by the appearance of these particular cadets, whether they are among the cadets that we saw before or they just happen to look the same since, you know, they're clones and maybe they are the same age. I don't know. I really don't think there's much we can take from it. Just like I don't think we can take much from Ahsoka's absence at this point, because there are so many other episodes, obviously, after she's around that don't have her in it. All the different things that we've been told are possible hints seem like they're only hints when it fits the situation. Otherwise, as a hint, it falls completely flat. There's just no way to say. And apparently, Filoni and those aren't talking yet at this point.
I don't know, Nathan. That spit curl looked awfully familiar on that clone's head.
It could very well be, or they could just be saying we're going to go back and reuse a lot of the same character models so we don't have to make new ones. I mean, we've seen clones with their helmets off who look similar to other clones we've seen before who aren't meant to necessarily be the same characters either. I mean, it's hard to say. It could very well be. I mean, maybe he's back again, you know, but I'm not certain. I don't think they ever named the character. I would say that's something we'd have to see if he's been named in the script, and that would usually be something that would pop up on one of those episode guides, and they didn't. So, and they did mention, you know, even Broadside, they mentioned, we saw Broadside last in Shadow of Malevolence. You would think that if the clone cadets, the young ones, were meant to be the same ones from the end of last season, that they would have noted it on the episode guide, but they didn't. In other words,
All right, guys. Well, that was the ARC Troopers episode, and thank you for that discussion. But, hey, let's talk about the preview for next week's episode. We go from two amazing clone episodes to Jar Jar.
That preview was like a punch in the gut after those two episodes. I was on such a high. I was so excited. I was like, oh, this is going to be a great season. This is going to be so much fun. And the preview was showing up, and it was that guy that Master Die or D, I can't remember his name. And so it's kind of indifferent. And then just Jar Jar shows up, framed on the screen. It's just like, no. I think I did a Darth Vader from episode 3. So, not happy.
Misa, mooey, mooey, confused. We get these clones, right? Listen, I'm not going to put it down. But the last episode we got with Jar Jar in it was Bombad Jedi. And we all know how well that went. So we got Jar Jar, and we have Organa, Senator Organa, and we all know how interesting Organa is, okay? So, I mean, it's going to I can't wait to hear the next episode of Republic Forces Radio Network after this episode.
Well, to be fair, I think the last episode that focused on Jar Jar was Gungan General, which actually wasn't a horrible episode.
True. Now, okay, I'm gonna pull a Barrett and Senate spy on this one. When it came to this preview, it didn't bother me saying that it was going to be an episode with some Jar Jar focus to it, because, I mean, really, in this series, Jar Jar's antics have made more sense than it did in, say, The Phantom Menace, or the way that he was goofy and the way that he talked in Attack of the Clones. I always say that Jar Jar's whole thing was, we see him as the clown, the jester to begin with, so that it's easy for us to understand how he could be the one hoodwinked into giving the Chancellor all of those emergency powers, thinking he's doing the right thing in Attack of the Clones. I mean, he is the, you know, he's the noble idiot in some respects, you might say. But so far in this series, the only thing that's really jarred me, no pun intended, about Jar Jar is the fact that they switched voice actors, and I don't particularly like the new voice actor they got for Jar Jar Binks. But his antics in Bombad Jedi, I actually found mildly amusing. I mean, it's an episode that wasn't meant to be entirely taken seriously. It had its serious points, but it was just a fun romp of an episode from a comedic standpoint. And Gunga Jinnah was kind of the same way. We saw the value in some of the stuff that Jar Jar could contribute there. Seeing Bail Organa, I just finished reading the novelization of The Force Unleashed 2 so that we could put it together for a review episode we're going to put out of the EU review on October 6th, the day that the novel comes out. And seeing that, again, got my interest up in Bail Organa, and I welcome seeing him again. I'd like to see him grow and get more depth. We saw him in Cat and Mouse and gave him a little bit more energy to it, I believe it was. So, you know, it's not quite what we got this week, but I think if we expected every week to be as butt-kicking, action-oriented, and a Band of Brothers-y as this week was with the two episodes back-to-back, I think we'd eventually get sick of it. We need different flavor, and, you know, bring it on. Bring on a Jar Jar episode. As long as it's not handled in a goofy manner to the point where it sort of ridicules itself, it works for me. Bombad Jedi was okay. Gungan General was okay. They're not my favorites, but the humor was handled well enough. Just please have the voice actor for Jar Jar be a better approximation of the film voice than we had previously, and go for it.
Okay, everybody. Thanks for joining us this week, and appreciate the conversation overall. And we will see you guys next week to discuss that very episode. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Have a good week, guys. Talk to you guys next week.
See you next time.
See ya.
Now, before we wrap up this week's episode of Republic Forces Radio Network, Brock has a book review for us, but before we get into that, we have a Hasbro Q&A. Question number one. At San Diego Comic-Con, you showed upcoming figure 2 packs included with an episode from the Clone Wars TV series. Yet, one of the packs had the DVD of Rising Malevolence, and the figure shown was the Ahsoka figure with Rada the Hutlet, clearly from the movie. Is that the final figure to be included with that set, or is that the right episode? Their answer. Yes, it will be the same Ahsoka. Rod is basically a bonus accessory that we included since, well, we had it. It's really a fun little dude to have. Question number two. Also in the figure DVD 2 packs, will all the figures in those sets be straight repacks of previously released figures, or will there be repaints, resculpts, or new figures in these packs? Their answer. All the figures will be straight repacks of figures that have been previously released. These are kid-targeted sets, and we did not want to change what we felt were already great figures. All right, well, once again, we want to thank Hasbro for answering our questions this go-around. Now, let's hand it over to Brock.
This is Brock, Star Wars Action News Book Club Liaison, with a spoiler-free-as-possible review of The Clone Wars, Gambit Stealth, and Gambit Siege, both written by Karen Miller. Review copies provided courtesy of Delray Books. The Clone Wars Gambit Stealth and Gambit Siege are follow-ups to Karen Miller's first Star Wars The Clone Wars book, Wild Space, which I reviewed on episode 186 of Star Wars Action News. Overall, while providing some nice character insights and eventually putting the story into motion, The Clone Wars Gambit Stealth soon gets repetitive in the information it gives us. The second book, Gambit Siege, is much stronger and seems to me to be the meat of the original story. By the time you get into Siege, you can tell this was a one-book story stretched over two. It's no secret that Ms. Miller was asked to write a third Clone Wars book after Karen Travis stopped her involvement in Star Wars. And the result is what we get here. Gambit Stealth and Gambit Siege that really don't have enough plot or action to bridge the story over 800 pages. My big issue with Miller's Wild Space was the lack of any real action or plot points. So the action battle scenes that start Stealth had me impressed, and I had high hopes as to where the book was headed. But as our heroes were given a furlough on Coruscant, and then we read about what they did on said furloughs, I started to wonder when the plot would kick into high gear. The author had opportunities to give us action scenes, and she didn't take them. For example, at one point in Stealth, Obi-Wan instructs Anakin to stay with her new doctor friend in her quarters as he goes off to alter the security holos. We don't follow Obi-Wan on what could have been a nifty stealth sequence through the compound. We stay with Anakin as he talks with a doctor about the hardships of being a slave. These books are full of that kind of insight into what makes our characters who they are. That is Miller's strength, and some of that here is great. And for those casual Star Wars fans out there who are picking up these books at an airport or for beach reading, they may enjoy all of the harbingers as to what is to come in Revenge of the Sith and getting to know the contentious relationship of Obi-Wan and Anakin. Yet the people most likely reading this series are Star Wars fans. Those of us who know the movies, listen to Republic Forces Radio Network, watch the TV show somewhat regularly, and even those of us who read the EU consistently. So the insights she provides the reader into the known characters and their motivations and their behaviors, while a good reminder the first time you read them, start to get a bit repetitive. The inherent problem with any Clone Wars novel, or Clone Wars EU for that matter, is we know where the Clone Wars started and we know where it will end. So us fans are looking for a good story, especially in novels, where you get inside the characters' heads. There is only so much foreshadowing that can be done before the characters start to look silly for not putting the pieces together sooner than they do in the movies. As the story moves into Gambit Siege, we get less of this foreshadowing as Obi-Wan and Anakin fend off the Separatist army from completely destroying a small mining village that provides the majority of the materials for the bioweapon. Miller's penchant for characters comes in great here as we learn about the villagers, their way of life, and how the Jedi are affected by them as they're trapped in the village waiting for backup from the Jedi Temple. There are some touching scenes as Obi-Wan befriends a Force-sensitive little girl who would have had an opportunity for a different life had she been born on a planet more central in the Republic. Bravo, Ms. Miller. I really enjoyed reading the characters of Locke Durd and Dr. Bantina. Those scenes are very well done, and you really get a sense of how evil Durd is and how he was able to manipulate the Doctor in her fears. The Jedi character of Tarya Danson is also a welcome surprise, especially with her interaction with Obi-Wan during his furlough in the beginning of Stealth and as she's called into action in Siege, and her interactions with Ahsoka are some of the best scenes in these books. Tarya's terminal illness is the most interesting character information we get in this duology, and it is about time these sorts of parallels to Earth sicknesses are included in the galaxy far, far away. I also have to give full props to the author for her presentation of Ahsoka. Miller's choices and insights on Ahsoka seem dead on to me, and what a joy it is to get inside of Ahsoka's mind as she deals with being a Padawan of the Chosen One, and as she learns she is picking up Anakin's good and bad traits. As proven with these two books, Karen Miller has a talent for crafting interesting and rounded characters. Yet, this duology needed a little less conversation and a little more action. I am convinced Clone Wars Gambit Siege and Gambit Stealth would make a stellar 450 to 500 page book. Instead, we have one okay and one good book. And that is a shame. I think Miller did some really great stuff here, but she essentially took one for the team. For Republic Forces Radio Network, Star Wars Action News, and the Star Wars Action News Book Club, this is Brock. Now back to the show.
Well, thanks, Brock. Well, everybody, that wraps up our premiere episode for Republic Forces Radio Network Season 3. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we will see you back this time next week as we review the third episode of Clone Wars Season 3 that will be on Cartoon Network this Friday night, September 24th. So long, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Berent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars, and all of the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademark Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a production of Inganza Media Incorporated, copyright 2010, all rights reserved.
You got that I
have to echo all, no pun intended, but I have to echo your guys' thoughts of this fantastic episode. All right.
Okay. I need to grab a drink and take a leak real quick, though it did just strike me. We certainly can't include it, but it'd be marginally amusing if one of the troopers, CT275555, was doing drugs and he'd be high fives. Get it? Like, woo! Anyway. Okay, I'll be right back.
I'll be back too. I have to take a break.
After this soft drink and peeing, I'll be right back.
All right, let's take five.
Two TMIs.
Okay, guys, on the second one, let's try to get this wrapped up by 10:30. Just
I can hear it in your voice, Jerry.
Yeah, you okay?
Well, I just can't hardly talk. It's frustrating. So
I'm sorry. I don't mean to be laughing, but
no. Well, I don't want you guys to think I'm frustrated at you. It just
you sound like you're hurting.
I get yeah. Like halfway through a sentence, I'm like Peter Brady all of a sudden, you know? So
you like record a little clip of you saying Barrent, Jen, you know, that kind of thing. So you don't have to at least say those.
Yeah.
Just like press the button. Like a soundboard. It's the Jerry soundboard.
Actually, if you guys want to own any of the segues in this conversation on the second half, I don't mind. I'll just, you know, that'd be great, Jen. What do you think, Jen? Nathan, take us down Continuity Corner. I just record one time. In fact, I'll take that out of a previous episode, which I had a voice. What's that?
Just take it from the last one and just copy it in there.
But coming off the episode before this, like, you know, I don't have a Blu-ray player. It's kind of like the A-Team dismembering a bomb or something like that. You know they're not going to get blown up. So why put the bomb in there every week? I guess I'm done. No.
I'm sorry. That slipped out. Keep going.
Yeah. So, it didn't feel different for me. I feel that if you want to give me different, then cut off Obi-Wan's leg. You know, for all we know, Obi-Wan could have a leg that's cybernetic. I mean, you never see his bare leg. You never see him in shorts. You know, he's always got his Jedi. You know, cut off his leg. Give him a leg. You know, give me something that next time when they fight, I mean, like, okay, you know, he got his leg cut off this time, you know, because he kind of does walk with a limp in A New Hope. Just let me put it out there.
Hey, Grievous. Nyuk, 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 nyuk.
Well, I just like to ask, you know, because it's something in my head that, you know, I like to get cleared up, which you didn't clear it up, so...
It's ouch! Better.
It's better that way.
Take that, Nathan P. You didn't clear nothing.
See, and he called me Nathan P. again. I told you he's the only one who calls me
young
that
man.
Mother.
young man.